Well, kia ora. Good afternoon, one and all. It's great to see the great crowd here today. I'm Joe Holland, the Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust, and we co-host these sessions with the Palmerston North City Library. I'll just acknowledge Jo Buckland over the other side there. She's the person that sends you all the emails. So thanks for giving us a bit of publicity, Jo. It's my pleasure again to welcome back one of our regular speakers, retired Rear Admiral David Leadsom, ex-Chief of Navy, Royal New Zealand Navy. David has been speaking to us for a number of years now about various experiences that he's had with the Navy, and with particular interests, not only naval interests, but interests within our area of interest. Last year, he spoke to us about this topic, the Canberra Agreement, the Truce Monitoring Group, and under the title of Soldiers Without Guns, of the experience they had in the mid to late 90s up in Bougainville. So without further ado, would you please welcome David as he talks to us about Soldiers Without Guns, Part 2.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd just like, at the outset, to make the point that I am not a historian. I like to consider myself to be a storyteller who focuses on stories based on non-fiction, not on fiction. When I agreed to Joe's request last year to tell a follow-on story, my one on the Navy's peace efforts in Bougainville in 1990, about the Truce Monitoring Group of 1997-98, I expected it to be a relatively easy task. After all, the Truce Monitoring Group arrived in Bougainville in October 1997, and after just 5 months was replaced by the Australian-led Peace Monitoring Group. So the overarching narrative looked initially to be a very smooth one. Trouble in Bougainville for almost 10 years. New Zealand steps in and takes the lead, and 5 months later, peace is essentially restored. However, a few weeks ago, as I started my reading in books and online, following this lead and that, and disappearing down a variety of holes, it became clear there was another storyline, one that was more bumpy, complex, and interesting. But it was a challenge to get together, and at times I worried that I would run out of time. And once again, the exercise highlighted for me the truth that the shape of the stories we tell about events from the past depends more on the perspective of the storyteller and their response to those events than it does on any ambition they may have to provide an accurate record of what actually happened. As an aside, I think a stark example of this point is found in the history of the Second World War, written by a renowned British historian, Sir Max Hastings. In his book on the Second World War, he writes, "It is a remarkable and important statistic that 99% of all ships which sailed from North America to Britain during the years of the war arrived safely. That may well be true, but the memory of seafarers as they reflected upon the fact that during the Battle of the Atlantic, 36,000 merchant mariners were killed and 3,500 merchant vessels sunk may be far more raw and less sanguine." These things just make me laugh. I was involved in a commenting on a medal submission to the Minister of Defence for a medal for service in Asia in the 70s. And one group of people, I think it was the SAS, were talking about the fact that it was a high-threat environment. They'd been at Fort Butterworth in 1977, I think it was, armed because of the high level of communist threat. At the same time we were across the harbour, we sailors rollicking from bar to bar. So here's one view of the Truce Monitoring Group and its place in the Bougainville story. So that's the advertisement for the movie. And this essentially is what the movie overview records. One view. And this is another. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade recalling is: the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade's role was characterised by careful and skilled diplomacy, but also moments of risk, luck, and opportunity. Over time, the personal integrity, commitment, and occasionally the bravery of New Zealand's diplomatic staff working in Port Moresby helped build the conditions required to start seriously working towards peace. At its heart, it is a story about New Zealand's place in the Pacific, the way we work with our neighbours, and the values which underpin our diplomatic effort. And various views are reflected in the description of the situation in Bougainville as: one, war; or two, conflict; or three, a crisis. The form of this story I'll be telling today. When I set out to put this story together, I was hoping it would take a simple linear form. I ended up, though, with something more complex, as I found out about the vital part played by the people and how they responded to events and opportunities, how they created or inhibited opportunities. It was a matter of people overwhelming events, I think, more so than events overwhelming people. I'll briefly discuss the situation in Bougainville in 1997, then show you a list of events associated with Bougainville's movement towards peace, then show you photographs of some of the people who feature in the Bougainville story. I'll then cover the lead-up to and deployment of the Truce Monitoring Group and the Peace Monitoring Group, and then subsequent events. I'll provide a bit more information on three key events, which I call critical events: the Sandline crisis, the shooting down of a helicopter with the New Zealand diplomat John Hayes on board, and finally, the Asian financial crisis. And I'll touch on the vital role of the Bougainvillean women. Finally, I'll look at the possibilities of Bougainville's future. This slide is purely there to remind us that it's at its heart, this is a story about Bougainville and its people. According to one source, the years of conflict since 1989 cost the lives of about 20,000 people, more than 10% of the population of 180,000. I do find when I'm online looking at these sorts of statistics, there's some discrepancy between the sources. So I'd just like to put a, another take on that. An Australian government publication reaches a more nuanced conclusion that the protracted and violent conflict in Bougainville has caused the deaths of hundreds of soldiers and rebels and an estimated 10 to 15,000 civilians, either from the fighting or from disease and deprivation. In addition to the deaths, more than 50% of the population became displaced. The infrastructure broke down completely. Whole villages were burned to the ground. Massive human rights violations, murder, torture, rape, and disappearances became daily occurrences. Internationally supported peace initiatives in late 1994 and early 1996 had been derailed by the Bougainville Revolutionary Army hardliners and rogue Papua New Guinea Defence Force elements. Violence between the rebels, the security forces, pro-government groups, and armed criminal gangs had taken on the character of a civil war. By early 1997, however, the feeling within the BRA, the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, was that they had the military advantage on Bougainville. They had, in the words of one of their commanders, overcome all that PNG had been able to throw at us. And so now, having attained a position of strength, was the time to negotiate with the PNG government. Providing additional compulsion to move to the table was that at the senior levels of the BRA, it was felt that we could not keep on fighting and fighting. The time had come to speak out and make our cries heard, and in particular, to let those in the international community know how we felt and why we struggled. There was no doubt the conditions on the island for the people was not sustainable. They were in desperate need of medical supplies, and few schools were operating. Furthermore, there was an overwhelming desire for peace within the community. As a former North Solomon's provincial government official recalls, the silent majority of Bougainvilleans were tired of war and longed to return to normal village life. Women's groups, church groups, and chiefs increased the pressure on both the BRA and PNG-backed Bougainville transitional government to negotiate for peace. On all sides, the likely cost of victory was proving too high. The moderate revolutionary leaders realised that even if they did win, they would inherit a hopelessly divided society. The reality was that things had reached the point that which peace had assumed for the vast majority of people a far higher priority than independence from Papua New Guinea. Then came the critical point of the Sandline Affair. Before moving on to that, I'd just like to briefly acknowledge the people who sit at the centre of the story. There are photos and brief bios of some of those who feature in it. Joseph Kabui. You can read that. So he died of a heart attack. He had refused medication. I had met Joseph Kabui when we were in Bougainville in 1990, and I recall that I had the Papua New Guinea government had a blockade operating, and I recall that I had some sweets that my wife had sent me. And I said to Joseph Kabui, "I have some sweets, would you like to take them home for your children?" And his response was, "No." A man of principle. Francis Ona, who started the whole thing from the Bougainville side and stood outside the process. He died of malaria at his village, Guava Village, which was very close to the Panguna mine. Sam Kawana, who was commander in the BRA, called the General of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, had been in the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. Ishmael Turama took over as the commander of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. He's currently the president of the Autonomous Region of Bougainville. Josie Saribi. She is the wife of Sam Kawana. So just briefly here that, you know, although the women wanted peace on Bougainville, they didn't all stand on the same side of the fence. Some on one side where independence mattered, and some where it was less important. The lady that you were with, Helen Hakena. Sister Lorraine Gadasu. So later on I'll touch on the fact that women play a critical role, and they have a critical role in Bougainville society. So Don McKinnon. Roger Mortlock. and John Hayes. So that's, as I said, just to make the point that this is about people, not just about events. The same line of fear, the first critical point. On becoming Prime Minister in August 1994, peace in Bougainville had been the main objective of the Prime Minister, Sir Julius Chan. While he adopted a number of different strategies to achieve this, his efforts ended up achieving little. Having originally rejected the mercenary option in September 1996, the frustrations generated by successive breakdowns in negotiations with the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, a series of humiliating setbacks, including the Kangu Beach Massacre in June 1996, in which 12 Papua New Guinea Defence Force and police personnel were killed and 5 taken hostage, and the prospect of an imminent general election, caused him to change his mind in late 1996 about how peace might be achieved. The Sandline proposal was first made public in an article published on 22nd February 1997 by an Australian journalist. In it, she revealed that the Papua New Guinea government had signed a contract with Sandline International, a private military company based in London, to blast the leadership of the BRA. At the time, Chan and his defence minister denied that Sandline personnel were to be employed to attack the BRA, saying that they would only be engaged in a training capacity. The Australian government made public their opposition to the Sandline proposals, which actually included Sandline carrying out a military strike, working with the Papua New Guinea Defence Force against key BRA leaders, destroying their communications and logistics capability, and recapturing the Panguna mine. The cost of the contract for the PNG government was estimated to be $36 million US. On 16th of March, the commander of the Defence Force, Brigadier General Sinarok, stopped Papua New Guinea Defence Force involvement in Sandline operations. He ordered the detention of Sandline personnel by the Papua New Guinea Defence Force in the evening of the 16th of March, and the following day, in a public act of defiance of the government, Sinarok spoke on national radio calling for the resignations of the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister. Chan responded almost immediately by dismissing Sinarok from his post, accusing him of gross insubordination bordering on treason, and appointing a new acting commander. There was, however, widespread public support for Sinarok, whose objections to the employment of mercenaries and allegations of corruption resonated within the community. In the week following 17th of March, Sandline personnel accepted their commander, a Brit named Spicer, were forced to leave the country. At this stage, the Australian government attempted in various ways to persuade both Chan and Sinarok to exercise restraint and maintain strong pressure on Chan to explore options other than the use of mercenaries to resolve the situation on Bougainville. On 25 March, with angry crowds surrounding the National Parliament, members of Parliament rejected a motion calling on the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister and Defence Minister to resign. The next day, while not resigning, the three agreed to step aside pending the outcome of a commission of inquiry into the Sandline contract. It seems to be generally agreed that had the contract gone ahead, it would have resulted in large-scale violence and potentially inflamed and protracted conflict on Bougainville. In addition, the economic and political dealings which took place as part of the Sandmine deal, particularly those surrounding the Panguna mine, which was at the heart of the conflict, could have adversely affected Papua New Guinea's long-term interests. Instead, the collapse of the Sandmine deal effectively ended any option of a military solution for Bougainville. Sinarok's actions and the controlled involvement of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force throughout the crisis also resulted in a more positive perception of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force among Bougainvillians. This contributed to the emergence of a more moderate Bougainville interim government and Papua New Guinea government leaders, and so opened up opportunities to make more substantial progress towards peace. Chan's defeat in the July election was another important factor in changing the mindsets of the various parties. Bougainvillians and the PNG government, under the newly elected Prime Minister Bill Skate, were now ready for peace negotiations. With a multitude of small steps marking the past, they were now hopeful of some big ones to shape the future.
And then I didn't know how to put this on a PowerPoint. So this is just a list of all the stuff that went on to try and resolve the conflict on Bougainville. A lot of stuff. A lot of it didn't result in peace, obviously. But there are people who say, but each step was making the foundation for what came afterwards. It's just a massive investment by a lot of people.
So now I turn to what's called Burnham One. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Don McKinnon, supported by his Australian counterpart Alexander Downer, stepped forward and took the leading role in grasping the opportunity presented by the shift in the strategic context. As I was writing this, I wondered what McKinnon's motivation to get involved might be, beyond a wish for a secure and stable Pacific, and noting that the tendency had been for Australia to focus on Melanesian matters and New Zealand on Polynesian matters. I think there were two compelling factors. The first was his personal background. His father was Major General Walter Sneddon McKinnon, CB, CBE, who died in 1998. He had joined the army in 1935 and served in the Second World War with various artillery units in the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force. After the war, he held a series of positions, senior positions in the army, ending his career as Chief of the General Staff, Chief of the Army, from 1965 to 1967. This background, I think, would have inevitably shaped McKinnon's worldview. The second influence, I think, was his view of the New Zealand-Australia relationship. A Canterbury University master's student, Rosemary Baird, in her 2008 thesis, Australia and New Zealand's Regional Peacekeeping Rights. The important theme which emerges from this overview that she had undertaken of Australian and New Zealand defence interaction is that it is simultaneously close and divergent. Because of their geographic proximity, shared British heritage, cultural similarity and intermigration, Australia and New Zealand do have broad complementary views on defence. Generally, however, threats and conflicts do draw the Australian and New Zealand Defence Forces closer together. Australia and New Zealand's defence relationship is one of siblings, not friends. Sometimes clingy and familial, at other times estranged and resentful, but generally united in the face of outside danger.
So following that thread, I found this article written in 2006 by Derek Quigley, who had served in the national government, which provides further insights to McKinnon's thinking. So McKinnon wrote to Quigley in an email talking about Australia and New Zealand. And he says, starts off talking about Australia. They have all this information, the sustained linkages, the inside track and broad relationship with the United States. We were the little kid across the way who had slammed the door in our own face. This email was sent in 2000. No one else had the opportunity that we in Australia had of sitting in such a way with the US. It was totally envied by everyone then. And those 2 days at the ANZUS meetings would be even more so today. The Australians were not unhappy that we were not going to be at the ANZUS table. And as I have said many times, instead of being a junior partner to the Australian military, we became a subservient partner. So there's a view. So I sense the man may be looking for an opportunity to make some changes to public perceptions. I was talking about Burnham One and the fact that McKinnon stepped up to take a leadership position. There had been informal communications between people in Bougainville and New Zealanders in the lead up to Bougainville, the talks at Burnham. And eventually it was agreed that there would be talks at Burnham, because that provided a place that was secure, and it was felt that security was an important factor, particularly for the vulnerable people. And it was only Bougainvillians who attended those talks in Burnham. They lasted from 3 to 18 July, and as I said, were attended only by Bougainvillean representatives from the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, the interim government, transitional government, as well as civil society leaders. And although no one was there from the central government of Papua New Guinea, they knew of the talks and had given their approval for them to proceed. New Zealand had brought the Bougainville parties, which numbered around 70 delegates, to New Zealand using the RNZAF. However, prior to them flying to New Zealand is what I refer to as the second critical point. The New Zealand diplomat, John Hayes, who had been the High Commissioner in Port Moresby and had been involved throughout, he was involved in the 1990 talks involving the Navy, was flying in a helicopter around Bougainville to uplift the delegates. As the aircraft moved into land near an area occupied by France's owner loyalists, it came under fire and was forced to land. Hayes reported the incident as a mechanical failure, keeping silent on the fact that the aircraft had been attacked. As a consequence of the shooting and his very measured response, a clear message was sent to the Bougainvillians that a New Zealander had been willing to risk his life in an effort to bring them together, and to be silent in the immediate aftermath of the incident about the danger to which he had been exposed. The message this sent was powerful. An interesting shadow to this incident was the role played by an Australian, Rosemary Gillespie, who died in 2010. She has been described as a lawyer, human rights activist, author and film producer who was active in human rights causes in Australia, the USA, Melanesia, the Pacific Islands and the Middle East for more than 40 years. When Frances' owner told her of the plan to meet in Burnham, she was heard to tell him over the phone that it was not now the time to negotiate, and he should only enter negotiations when she told him to do so. As Sam Coana remembers, one of the reasons that caused Frances to reject peace was that Rosemary Gillespie reinforced his views on the military option as a complete way of achieving Bougainville's aspirations. Now, why Rosemary was so influential over Frances is a question that remains a mystery to us. The Australian Quakers Journal of September 2016 said of her, "She never let controversy stop her from doing what she saw as right for humanity." Clearly, she also never let the human cost stop her. As a philosopher once said, "Yesterday I was clever and wanted to change the world. Today I'm wise and want to change myself." Gillespie may have been clever, but I'm unconvinced that she was wise. New Zealand was careful not to impose solutions or time limits on the Burnham talks. As a result, there was no set agenda, and the two weeks they lasted turned out to be worthwhile. They produced the Burnham Declaration, which included a ceasefire. It committed the parties to seek unity and reconciliation among the Bougainvillean people and to work with the government of Papua New Guinea to set up a process of negotiations between the leaders of Bougainville and Papua New Guinea. Another agreement was reached. The Bougainville interim government and the BRA announced that they would release 5 Papua New Guinea Defence Force soldiers they had been holding as prisoners for almost a year. I mentioned them in the beach massacre. They were handed over to New Zealand representative by the BRA, and then boarded the HMNZS Canterbury for return to Port Moresby. There was a second round of talks, and they got underway on 1 October. This time, Australia provided the transport for the Bougainville participants. An Australian Department of Foreign Affairs official was present at Burnham throughout the talks, although he, like New Zealand officials, was not an active participant in the talks. This time, representatives of the Papua New Guinea government, including the Deputy Commissioner of Police and the Commander of the Defence Force, were at the talks. A group also came from the Solomons. The Solomons group presented an interesting logistics problem, because the delegation, which included a former Governor General, was not formally part of the negotiations. This was resolved by accommodating the Solomons delegation in Christchurch, while the PNG officials and Bougainvillians were at Burnham. So there was tension between PNG and the Solomons, because support for what was happening in Bougainville had come from the Solomon Islands. So there was a degree of tension in that relationship. In the end, the Solomons Home Affairs Minister chaired the talks and a subsequent meeting in Cairns. The main outcome of the second round of talks at Burnham was the Burnham Truce. It set up a truce monitoring group, the deployment of which to Bougainville was named Operation Balisi. The truce monitoring group. From the outset, it was agreed that New Zealand would make up a substantial part of the truce monitoring group and lead it. It was also agreed that Pacific, in this case Melanesian, country participation was critical. According to Joseph Kabui, New Zealand leadership was another thing that made it less likely that Frances Ona would be a threat. This was one of the reasons Australia could not have led the TNG. Frances Ona would have come out shooting. None of the Bougainville leaders nor grassroots Bougainvillians would have accepted Australian leadership. The initial element of the TNG arrived in Bougainville in October. It was a fairly strong team of New Zealand and Australian Defence Force people
led by New Zealander Colonel Clive Lilly. They arrived in Bougainville in two separate groups. According to a New Zealand Army officer who was a member of the party, and this goes back to some of the earlier stuff I've been saying, following the arrival of the Australians, there was some friendly posturing between the Australians and New Zealanders. The Australians wanted a delayed and fully planned approach to Arawa, with us opting to move immediately. The New Zealand approach was to maximise exposure of the TMG to the greatest possible number of Bougainvillians in the shortest time possible. So later on I mentioned this, you know, this Australian, the Australian approach to risk. And I remember there was an operations in the Solomons. I was the fleet commander from the Navy side, and I was told the Australian Navy would not let New Zealand helicopters land on the Australian ships because they were unhappy with the insurance policy that we had. And I mean, I just told our people to tell the Australians it was operations and get over it. But, you know, that risk management can get out of control in any organisation, but particularly in a defence force, and it impacts on the culture. I was told a story of a young officer taking an Australian patrol craft into Darwin Harbour. He's communicated back to Sydney to ask whether it was safe for him to continue into the harbour. The truce monitoring group itself, led by Brigadier Mortlock, was deployed into Bougainville on 6 December 1997. Its strength was around 250 personnel, 120 New Zealanders, around 20 military police personnel from Fiji and Vanuatu. So the military were from Fiji. Vanuatu doesn't have a military force, so it was the police from Vanuatu. Australia provided between 90 and 110 people over the life of the truce monitoring group from December 1997 to March 1998, with 15 to 20 of these being civilians. The deputy commander of the truce monitoring group was an Australian civilian. Additionally, a detachment of Iroquois helicopters was deployed from November through to April 1998, and for varying periods the Navy provided the ships Canterbury, Manawanui and Endeavour to support the operation. Now, what some of my reading, the statement was made that as part of the Burnham talks, it was agreed the Papua New Guinea Defence Force would withdraw from Bougainville. But I came across a quote from Brigadier Mortlock, which indicated that was incorrect, because according to him, and he would have known, they kept a battalion of soldiers on the island, but they did nothing. Just stayed in their compound, played sport, that sort of thing, to give the peace accord a chance to work. I admire them for that. But also, in some of the stuff I came across, there was talk about Papua New Guinea Defence Force people actually going out into the field as well. So it's quite difficult to focus in on what exactly happened. In simple terms, the task of the truce monitoring group was to establish a secure atmosphere in which, and this is really the key point I want to make, in which Bougainvillians could forge their own peaceful solution to the conflict. It was agreed with the Bougainvillians that while the Australians would provide the bulk of the logistics support, military personnel from Australia would at least initially be restricted to the logistics areas. Now, I mean, the Australian relationship goes back to the fact that Panguna Mine was Australian owned and operated. Australian Iroquois helicopters provided to the Papua New Guinea Defence Force had, according to some people, been used to take people out to sea and drop the bodies out of the aircraft. And the Australians obviously supported the Papua New Guinea Navy, and that had been involved in enforcing a blockade of the island.
So these were the threads of the feeling that Bougainvilleans had towards Australia. And of course, you know, Papua New Guinea was a former colony of Australia's, and Australia is separated from Papua New Guinea by a very short distance at the northern tip of the continent. However, while New Zealanders and... But I mean, it wasn't all black and white. So while New Zealanders and other contributing nations would provide most of the monitors in the field, Australia was welcomed by the Bougainvilleans to include civilian monitors in the field teams. In fact, at the outset of the truce monitoring group, the BRA refused to sanction any participation of uniformed people from Australia, although agreeing to the use of civilian people. It was not until after the initial rotation of personnel that enough trust had been built to allow for Australian military participation, and in the end, for Australian leadership of the peace monitoring group. So, you know, between the arrival of the TMG and the establishment of the peace monitoring group, which was about 5 months, there was a turnaround in the attitude towards the Australian. The truce monitoring group operated out of 4 bases, out of which they drove, walked, or were flown into villages, many of them remote and in the mountains. They stressed to the Bougainvilleans that they were on the island to provide a stable environment for peace, and attended dozens of meetings and ceremonies to make themselves and their mission known. Although its life was short, the TMG had a positive impact on the course upon which Bougainville was set. Helen Harkenna, one of the leading women in the Bougainville peace movement, said, "In addition to creating an environment in which fighting between the BRA and the PNGDF was no longer possible, the TMG bridged gaps and hatred between clans, villages, relatives, and even churches, which in one way or another were involved in the crisis." It has also been said that it was an opportunity for peace for the PNGDF, no less than it was for Bougainvilleans, and that the TMG kept the warring parties apart physically, and it provided the link that allowed them to start communicating. And finally, the TMG provided a window into what everyone was doing in Bougainville, and that meant everyone could be held accountable for their actions. It is important, though, I think, to acknowledge the Bougainville perspective captured by Sam Kohana. He said, "Overall, the TMG Bougainville relationship was excellent. We felt responsible because we had ownership of the peace process, and we invited them to the island as our guests." So this bit about, you know, the hatred between clans and that, it was quite intense. And, you know, I have a personal view. I hate the whole concept of payback, just as I think the concept of the philosophy of Utu is a debilitating philosophy. And I'll never ever forget the first time I went to Papua New Guinea. We anchored in Port Moresby, and the defence attaché and army officer came on board and said to us, "Before you go ashore, you need to understand the concept of payback. Here is how it works. Recently, some men from one village went to another village and raped some women. Men from the village of those women went back to the village the men had come from and raped men. So it's not a basic concept of revenge, it's revenge in kind." Moving on now to the Lincoln Agreement. In January 1998, Don McKinnon convened another round of talks, a round of talks in Christchurch, and oversaw the negotiation of the Lincoln Agreement.
This extended the truce to a permanent and irrevocable ceasefire on 30 April and established the Australian-led Peace Monitoring Group to replace the Truce Monitoring Group, as well as the creation of a Bougainville Reconciliation Government, a process for weapons disposal, the withdrawal of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force from Bougainville, and the granting of amnesties and pardons was also agreed. After a further round of negotiations, this time in Canberra, in March 1998, and with the beginning of a permanent ceasefire at the end of April, the character of the troops in Bougainville changed, in particular New Zealand's role. New Zealand Defence Force personnel were reduced from 220 to only 30, and Australia took over the leadership with the agreement of all parties, in spite of the reservations that still existed against Australia. The Peace Monitoring Group consisted initially of about 300 personnel, including 90 peace monitors and about 200 support personnel. The majority, between 240 and 250 of the Peace Monitoring Group's personnel, were Australian. As late as July 1998, 3 months after the establishment of the Peace Monitoring Group, issues with monitoring operations and morale remained apparent. In his book on Bougainville operations, Australian Colonel Bob Breen attributes much of the internal friction and insensitive behaviour regarding political and cultural issues to poor personnel selection and inadequate pre-deployment training on the part of the Australian and New Zealand contingents. An obvious part of the problem, he writes, was a disorganised transition from the TMG to the PMG, typified by the fact that no Australians who had served with the TMG were invited to brief the next rotation of personnel on conditions in Bougainville. And that sort of resonates with me, because when the TMG was being put together, I was in the same office as Brigadier Mortlock and had been involved in the Endeavour Accord in 1990. And there was no thought by anyone planning the TMG to speak with the Navy people who had been involved in that particular activity. After 2000, the Peace Monitoring Group was reduced to 200 people, and following the Arawa Peace Agreement in August 2001, the PMG focused on facilitating the weapons disposal pull-up of the agreement, instilling community confidence in promoting the implementation of the agreement in cooperation with a small United Nations observing mission. So finally the United Nations becomes involved in Bougainville. From late June 2003, the Peace Monitoring Group was replaced by a small Bougainville transition team of 17 unarmed civilians that operated until the end of the year. A major success of the Peace Monitoring Group's contribution to providing the Papua New Guinea government with sufficient confidence to gazette the constitution for the autonomous region of Bougainville in December 2004, and the region held successful elections in June 2005. So the key message really is the TMG moves in, and then there's a slow descent into peace over the next few years. This next bit I've called the ANZAC relationship works despite the differences. It's based largely on the views of Rosamund Baird in her 2008 thesis. According to her, conflict and disharmony between trans-Tasman representatives, in particular military forces, is the untold story of the Bougainville peace process. And the TMG was an exception to general military practice, where a coalition is led by the larger and wealthier nation. As alluded to by Don McKinnon, the Australia-New Zealand defence relationship was tense in 1997. In large measure because of what the Australians considered to mean New Zealand's low level of defence spending. Now, the Australians have always had a condescending view of New Zealand, and this is just making the point. And they have had, this is just digressing a bit, but I keep reminding people, the only reason that New Zealand got, well, the principal reason New Zealand got two frigates is because Keating from the Australian government, who could have been the Deputy Prime Minister, came over and said to the New Zealand government, you don't buy the Anzac frigates, forget closer economic relations. That's reality. Not because the New Zealand government said we need them for our defence or any of that sort of thing. Because the Australians delivered the ultimatum. Because of Australian concerns, New Zealand's early attempts to involve the Australian Defence Force in Bougainville were rejected. The Australian Chief of Defence Force and his senior officials were unenthusiastic. They made it clear that the Australian Defence Force wanted nothing to do with a New Zealand-led operation. Australian Department of Defence civilians were unsupported. Some of the Australian senior officers assessed that the NZDF's planning and style of operation was backward and unprofessional. There was a genuine concern that New Zealand had run down its defence capacity and was incapable of managing the Bougainville operation. As Brigadier Mortlock admitted, there were many reasons that made the inclusion of Australia essential, not the least of which was the inadequacy of our own logistics capability. New Zealand alone did not have the capacity to provide full logistics support. As I've mentioned before, the two military forces had different approaches to risk management and different risk appetites. The Australians expected to have reliable 24-hour communications and vehicles driven by qualified drivers. The NZDF, Rosemary Baird posits, perhaps because of its lack of resources, was content to deploy without such necessities. The New Zealand military radios and jeeps were untrustworthy and potentially unsafe, a situation which worried Australian communications and transport officers. Rosemary Baird records that the difference in approach was demonstrated when the Australian-led Peace Monitoring Group took over in 1998 and immediately put in place a force which was larger and better equipped than the TNG. Indeed, a major operational problem for the New Zealand and Australian forces in Bougainville was the NZDF's inadequate provision of equipment, resources and personnel. New Zealand did not have the capacity to provide communications for the TMG. The Land Rovers New Zealand sent the TMG were notoriously dreadful, rusted, dangerous and unroadworthy. The vehicles were assessed by the Royal Australian Mechanical Engineers as unsafe. She concludes that in spite of these tensions between the two nations, many New Zealanders and Australians chose to focus on the positives rather than the negatives of the TMG. It is perhaps to be expected that Australia's Foreign Minister Downer only mentioned the close collaboration between Australia and New Zealand in the Bougainville peace process in his official publication on Bougainville. However, even in individual interviews, New Zealand participants in particular glossed over trans-Tasman discord. Perhaps this occurred because of the popular perception of Bougainville as a separate operation. So that's what Rosemary Baird puts in her thesis. And I mean, I do know, for example, that the Australian Navy people that I were dealing with rejoiced when New Zealand was thrown out of Anzac. They were jubilant. And they leveraged that as much as they could to open the gap between Australia and between New Zealand and the United States. But I also know that during my time in the military, I took the relationship with Australia for granted, and I never worked at it to the extent that I should have. And you know, when, as the point's been made, when there's a point of stress or danger, then we come together. And I had a situation where there was an accident in HMNZ Canterbury, a sailor was killed, and I needed to replace the rubber boats to keep the ships at sea. We had none in New Zealand. And I phoned the Australian Chief of Navy and said, I've got an issue. I understand you're a production runner of boats. Can you give me the first boats off the run so I can get my ships back to sea? And he didn't hesitate. He said, yes, of course. So it's a complex relationship, point is made, of siblings. You know, there's competition, but there's also a real closeness. The next section I've got on this is called The Asian Financial Crisis and New Zealand Risks Throwing Away All That Has Been Gained. The Asian financial crisis is the third critical point. It was a period of financial crisis that gripped much of East Asia and Southeast Asia beginning around July 1997, and it raised fears of a worldwide economic meltdown. The direct effect on the New Zealand economy was adverse and substantial and looked like it to continue for some time. The indirect through business and household sector confidence was also significant. In response, when Jenny Shipley ousted Jim Bolger as Prime Minister in December 1997, she made several decisions to cut government costs, one of which was to substantially reduce New Zealand's contribution to operations in Bougainville. Don McKinnon said he did not want to have to pull out in Bougainville, but was crunched by the Treasury. I mean, ministers always say this, but Treasury is like anyone else, they are advisors. The accountability shoots home to the ministers. As a consequence of New Zealand's decisions, and without officially consulting the Australian Defence Force, the NZDF appeared to also be defaulting on its logistics obligations. The NZDF also pulled out SAS personnel who were important in guaranteeing the team's security. There is a view that all members of the TMG experienced unnecessary hardship and danger because of the New Zealand government's decision. And when New Zealand defaulted on its logistical and personnel commitments during the second rotation of the Truce Monitoring Group, young New Zealanders and Australians on the ground were drawn closer together and shared adversity. In April 1998, according to Sam Kawana, Bougainvillean, a strong sense of rejection was felt when the New Zealand government handed the monitoring role to the Australians. There was an accusation then that New Zealand must have collaborated with Australia to hand over the peace process to Australia. We were, of course, very concerned when the TMG came to an end, the PMG arrived, and Australia took over the lead. But that concern was less to do with the Australians themselves, and more a worry that we did not know why New Zealand was leaving and pulling out most of its personnel. In this context, I don't think it is unfair to the New Zealand memory of Bougainville and our contribution to its peace to reflect on the words of a prayer by the noted 16th century English seafarer Admiral Sir Francis Drake. There must be a beginning to any great matter, but the continuing until the end, until it be thoroughly finished, yields the true glory. Just briefly, the role of women. Most social groups are what are called matrilineal societies, so women own the land and children take the surname of the women. But someone makes the point, matrilineal doesn't mean matrimonial, matriarchal. So the war affected women in the government and controlled areas of Bougainville differently, but they all suffered deeply. Lieutenant Colonel Janet Castell, who served with TNG in New Zealand, observed that the women knew they had to reinstate some form of healthcare, education, and roading system. They knew they had to reconcile the differences that had originally led to the conflict, and they had to reconcile amongst themselves, which was often difficult too. Women's groups played a major role in working for peace and reconciliation at local, national, and actually at international levels. They used their status in the family to negotiate peace in their communities and managed to use their influence as go-betweens with the warring factions to maintain constructive dialogue. Mothers went into the bush to attempt to bring their sons home. In South and Southwest Bougainville, women went into the jungle to negotiate with the local brahmin. Bougainville today. So, 97 did all this stuff, and we've transitioned to peace today. Bougainville's economy remains weak, with its government still financially dependent on Papua New Guinea and international aid donors. Its people continue to struggle. The maternal mortality rate is estimated to be 3 times higher than in Papua New Guinea. It is already among the worst in the world, with 230 deaths per 100,000 births. The Papua New Guinea National Research Institute estimates that the island has a GDP per capita of about $1,100 US. This would place the newly independent Bougainville among the ranks of countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Niger and Somalia, which face notable challenges in poverty, health and stability. Approximately 85% of Bougainville's government revenue is from Papua New Guinea. The Panguna mine today, the source of much of it. On the 6th of May this year, it was announced that the controversial Panguna mine, which lay derelict for more than 30 years following the eruption of a civil war in Bougainville, is set to be revived to support the region's plans for nationhood. The autonomous Bougainville government has secured an agreement with local landowners to move ahead with plans to reopen the vast open-cut copper mine in the central mountains of Bougainville Island that was at the centre of the conflict. That said, the private sector may be reluctant to invest in restarting the mine, given the likely cost estimated to be in the region of $4 billion and the potentially hostile community response. Shaping the future for Bougainville. Bougainville President Ismail Toroama has said, "Bougainville's political aspirations and independence must never be compromised if Bougainvillians wish to fulfil the choice by 97.7% of the people who opted for independence from Papua New Guinea in the 2019 Bougainville referendum. Papua New Guinea's government has accepted the result, despite concerns that Bougainville's departure could cause the ethnically and linguistically diverse country to fracture, but it has so far refused to commit to full independence. In April this year, Bougainville's quest for independence inched closer, with both governments endorsing a key document. At a meeting, the joint supervisory body meeting in Port Moresby, both governments committed to the Irukone Covenant, which sets out how the independence referendum results will be tabled in the National Parliament and the manner in which that institution may ratify the results. President Toroama remains positive about the future for Bougainville and is confident that both governments together have developed a decisive path on the future political status of Bougainville. And the pressure is on the Papua New Guinea government. Bougainville's leaders have set a deadline for 2027 to gain full independence from Papua New Guinea. Bougainville faces two popular futures, each quite different in form, but potentially alike in their outcomes. In one, if the Papua New Guinea government does not agree to independence, then according to one commentator, guns could come out of hiding, guns could come back from the Solomon Islands, and warlords once again have a large following. And the other, another commentator's view is that in the event of an independence vote and a negotiated settlement on independence reached with Papua New Guinea government, Bougainville would require substantial assistance from both PNG and external partners such as Australia in making the transition to independence and fiscal self-reliance. Yet to date, there is scant evidence of planning for such a transition, if that is the outcome of the referendum and negotiations. The United States publication in October 2013 concluded that a Bougainville government that does not have the resources or the oversight capacity to provide basic services to its population would be a grave threat to stability. I do not know whether the bird I can just see circling in the high in the sky above Bougainville is a dove or whether it is a hawk. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou.
Very good, David. Just goes to show how complex some of these operations can be. I know we've gone over time, but I'm sure there might be a few questions. So please fire away. Are there any questions, David?
Is there a hypothesis about where China comes into this and is
contemporary
tomorrow? Yes. Yeah, what's quite interesting is I think essentially the I think we now need to start thinking of the South Pacific as a region with Australia and New Zealand part of but outside of it. Because recently, I think just yesterday, the Pacific Island nations agreed on the procedure for leadership of the Pacific Island Forum without including New Zealand and Australia. I think that China is doing what it's doing because I think to a degree it's about face, and I have a view that to a large extent they're doing what we've accepted from the United States of America for years. It's about a world. This is where New Zealand. New Zealanders don't really have a world view of themselves, I don't think, but a lot of other countries do have a strong view of their place in the world. I think that's the strength of Australia, and I think, you know, with economic power, China is starting to form a world view. All the stuff that's going on in the Spratly Islands, the South China Sea, I was taught about them as a threat when I first joined the Navy. That's been going on for years and years and years. I don't think, in my own heart, there's an emotional connection between the Pacific countries and China. And although we may be colonial powers, Australia and New Zealand, I mean, there is an emotional connection. So I'm doing some stuff with Fiji as a non-government organisation. And I say to people, when I speak to the guys in Fiji, we can talk about rugby. I can't talk to people from China about rugby. Well, that sort of stuff. You know, so there's not that. I think China will keep on doing what it does, but I don't think it'll be part of any solution. And they didn't get the security agreement that they wanted with the countries in any event. So I think that the Pacific countries will focus on taking a regional view amongst themselves. That's my feeling.
Any other questions? David, personal relationships is something that we spoke about before you. Do you want to make a comment at all about the value, not only within the Pacific region, but, you know, in amongst the Australia, well, you mentioned the Australian-New Zealand Defence Force relationships. Do you want to make any further comment on
that? Well, all I would say is that at the end of the day, everything comes down to individuals and whether they can get on with each other and how they respond to each other. And this little NGO I'm working with, it's a great frustration that we can't actually engage face-to-face with the people we're talking to in Fiji in particular, and in the Federated States of Micronesia. We can have Zoom meetings or Google Meet meetings, but it's not the same thing. And the only way you can, I think, overcome the limitations of these virtual meetings is you've got to be very sensitive around the empathetic space. When you're dealing with people whose first language is not necessarily English. But you know, a lot of countries, I don't think, get the personal dimension. And when I was dealing with the United States Navy, they just don't understand that they can give a lot of money to people and a lot of assistance to people, but people actually end up resenting it. And people give the wrong aid. I remember going to Papua New Guinea, and my wife went to a hospital in Port Moresby. People had spent a whole lot of money, whether they were, they'd had spares or not, but they donated very high-tech beds to the hospital. What the hospital needed was very, very effective mattresses, not the beds. And it was mattresses not just for the patients, but for the families who sit around the beds of the people who are ill. So, to find the right thing, and this is what this little NGO, we're saying, and we're in discussions with people in the UK, and we're saying the Fijians are going to tell us what they want. It's not going to be us. And constantly asking the Fijian representatives, is this what you want? Is this the pace you want to move at? Are you comfortable with what we're doing? Constantly. And I just get so frustrated when I travel around the world. I went to Port Moresby a couple of times. I went to see the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Port Moresby, in his office. And I walked through a building and the roofs were falling down, the walls were falling down. I thought they're renovating. It's renovations. It wasn't. It was falling apart. Because what large countries give small countries is infrastructure. They provide capital, but they don't provide the money needed to maintain these things through their life. So they actually saddle these countries with a track to increase debt. So this is a real challenge. I'm sorry. I feel very emotional about it because it's a simple thing to do, to speak to people and to listen to people. Yes?
Paraphrase what you said about the reason that the war stopped in Bougainville was through poverty and exhaustion from all sides. Now, I've worked in Bougainville for 9 months as an instrument engineer at Copper Monday. We found that 2 beers was the maximum we could ever have at a party per person, because otherwise they start squaring off and violence is just under the surface. And that's even within groups within Bougainville, not to mention so my question is if the mine was to reopen or any resources to be put into Bougainville, would the existing unity between the different tribes and factions in Bougainville survive, or would disunity and friction break out again?
As I said, is it a dove or is it a
Is
it a hawk? And what's striking when you look at the people, like Joseph Kabui, dead. So a lot of the people who had been exhausted by the previous conflict have now gone. Now the current president was took over from San Juan as commander of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. So it depends on the conditions under which the mine opens, the extent to which the environmental concerns of the local people are addressed, the dispersal of the economic benefit of the mine, because one of the issues was outsiders coming into, it's not only white people who are accused of being racist, brown people and black people are too, and there was racism, there were racist feelings about people from PNG coming into Bougainville. I mean, the great tragedy is, you just need to look at a map to know it's part of the Solomon Islands, not part of Papua New Guinea. And bloody colonists back in the day said, well, we'll make it part of Papua New Guinea because that's where Germany had it. And I was just thinking, in response to your question, well, look at Ireland. I mean, it's still a divided country. So I don't know. I pulled out a little bit on, because this whole thing of, as I said, payback interests me. So I won't use this, but here's something that, that you might find interesting. Local reconciliation efforts began almost as soon as the conflict began, gathered momentum through the 1990s and continued at the time of writing. There has long been recognition in Bougainville that reconciliation takes decades rather than years. In some areas, reconciliation processes following intertribal fighting occasioned by World War II continued into the 1980s. You know, and the other thing, you know, being a New Zealander, there's a whole lot of angst and agony that happens amongst Maori that many Pākehā are not exposed to. And you know, I was told of an army guy bringing some Ngāpuhi people through Waikato and asking this Pākehā guy to close the windows of his car so they didn't have to smell Tainui, because they hadn't fought in the war and Ngāpuhi had. So there are all these eddies and whirls and swirls just going on all over the place. And I come from Ōtaki. So Te Rauparaha goes into Ōtaki and decimates the local people who are up in Pōkau, who are left with a little bit of land at, in Levin now. And they will refer to Te Rauparaha as a murderer. But there's a statue in Ōtaki for Te Rauparaha, and no one says, take it down, because that guy's a murderer and a slave owner. So, you know, there are all these tensions and stresses that just bubble away. And it's just amazing when you get insights into them. And it's bad enough between the Navy and the Airport.
David, thanks. It's quite a complex story. It's one we can probably go on and talk about for some time. The Pacific is quite a complex area, and I'm not sure that any of us have got any answers as to what's going to happen in the future. So once again, please put your hands together and thank David for a very...